the Second World War impacted America in profound and lasting ways. With millions mobilized to fight abroad or work on the war effort at home, Hollywood played a central part in providing the narratives and moving pictures that would come to define the war and our cultural response to it. A new book expertly crafts a tale of five filmmakers and an entire industry that rallied to not only document but also dramatize America's war experience. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. The engrossing book, Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War, has just been issued in paperback, and I'm happy to have its author, Mark Harris, on the program today. Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks so much for speaking with us. The book has been out in hardback in 2014, but the paperback is just out, and it's an engrossing read, I have to say. An enormous subject that you've expertly distilled into a number of threads that run throughout, and those threads are really centered around these five Hollywood directors. How did you choose these five men to center the story?
Well, I think really they chose me. I mean, I love having the option of multiple characters in narratives. You know, it gives you something to cut to, which I think writers and filmmakers both like. But in this case, the five filmmakers who are John Ford, William Wyler, John Huston, Frank Capra, and George Stevens really kind of presented themselves naturally because they were five guys, all of whom had very successful careers in Hollywood at the time of Pearl Harbor. And also, really because of their success, they were, more than any other Hollywood directors who went to war, given positions of authority where they really had some chance to make a difference. So when I looked at it and I thought, who am I going to work with, to cut any one of these guys from the narrative would have meant losing something really valuable. And there was no sort of secret sixth director to add. These guys were kind of in rarefied territory in Hollywood, so it really was their story.
I should mention, too, though, while telling their story, you are talking about the industry at large, and there's lots of other characters that weave themselves into the story. But I knew that a lot in the film industry went off to war, but I did not know that it was nearly a third of all of the Hollywood movie industry. That was just a staggering statistic that comes out of your book.
Yeah, it startled me, too, because it really reminds you that there are two stories just in regard to that. One is the gigantic force of people with expertise in filmmaking who went to war and had that expertise deployed, because this was really the first war that was planned from the beginning to be extensively documented on film. And the other story is, of course, how that loss of 30% of the male workforce changed Hollywood during the war years and changed the kind of movies that were made and changed who was starring in them and really, you know, altered everything.
This year we will mark the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II, and yet 70 years on, it is still one of the defining narratives for this country and our history. And One of the interesting things I took from your book is that while all of these directors and many in Hollywood responded quickly by enlisting or offering their services, John Ford, one of the five directors you profile, seemed to instinctively have known that war was coming. And he also seemed to know how important it would be that this war needed to be documented.
Yeah, it's really remarkable that Ford had these two very prescient instincts. One, that war was absolutely inevitable, which many of his colleagues did not believe, and two, that it was going to be very, very important that capable filmmakers were involved. So many, many months before the war started, he began spending nights and weekends training studio sound men and technicians and editors and cinematographers in how to film and process film under wartime conditions. And a little bit, this was kind of a fun thing for Ford and his pals to do on weekends. But, of course, after December 7th, it became not theoretical. You know, these guys who thought maybe they would possibly be called into service were all essentially called into service. And by then, Ford himself had been out of Hollywood and in the Navy for 3 months. He left in September 1941 because he absolutely was certain that war was coming.
You mentioned all five of these were prominent directors, and certainly in the case of Frank Capra, probably the wealthiest director in Hollywood. He was a millionaire, had already won 3 Oscars. John Ford himself was one of the most respected directors. And William Wyler and John Huston and George Stevens were certainly in the moment. All of them, though, were at or beyond the age for enlistment. And it's interesting, the tales of how they each found themselves in the military with almost no training, a new uniform, usually a high rank, and how oftentimes those two cultures did not mesh well. They'd come from Hollywood, where they were, as you say in the book, basically generals on their own set, and now they were dealing with this massive bureaucracy.
Yes, it's. I mean, they were, as you said, men between mid-30s and mid-40s, very established, all of whom had lived somewhat pampered lives. None of whom had to serve. They all accepted officers' commissions and went to war. And, you know, it was really interesting to discover that they were treated with a kind of combination of respect, contempt, and disregard. There was a sense that these were people with a very special talent who nonetheless had no real place in the Army and were viewed by the kind of longstanding Army bureaucracy as just dilettantes who weren't going to contribute anything real of substance or value to the war effort. They also got no training. Wyler often talked about how he, you know, went from being a private citizen to a uniformed officer overnight. And so the great filmmaking effort of the war that they were all responsible for was almost completely their initiative. I mean, they really had to figure out, it wasn't just following orders, they had to figure out what the orders should be and what they were going to do.
And each found a way to bring their distinctive style and approach to filmmaking to that. I gather at times the Army and Navy and other branches had their own view of the kinds of films they might be producing, and oftentimes their product differed sometimes dramatically from what the brass thought they were going to be getting.
I think that's true, and the suspicion and distrust also went both ways. I mean, Ford in particular really chafed under the authority of the Navy. He did not like being bossed around in Washington any more than he had in Hollywood. And Capra told his wife that his experience working for studio heads had given him all the experience he needed in terms of dealing with higher-ups in the Army, which is, he said, the only thing to do is not to give them an inch.
Somewhere along the way, though, I get the sense, reading through these stories, that the products they're putting out, which are not what we would today call documentaries, though they often included footage, actual war footage, but they would often come back to Hollywood to cut their films together, to polish them up. They sometimes put full film scores under them, got some of their Hollywood buddies to do voiceovers. I mean, these were propaganda films in perhaps the most positive light, in that they were trying to shape public opinion and resolve. And while those films didn't match maybe the expectation of the higher-ups that had hired them, it seemed to me that the military quickly understood that these men had specific intuitions about how to move audiences.
I think that's true, and I think it's true from the very beginning of the war. This whole thing happened because of the instinct of General George Marshall that, first of all, the war should be documented on film, and second, and this was a really kind of fascinating counterintuitive moment for him, that the people who should do the documenting shouldn't be newsmen or the guys who made newsreels. They should be Hollywood directors who knew how to reach an audience's emotions and move them through entertainment. I mean, that, in retrospect, is a really peculiar choice, but one that resulted in some very powerful and idiosyncratic pieces of war filmmaking.
And one of the first proofs you give in the book of that strategy is that John Ford is sent off to Midway Island early in the war, and he's there personally with a small crew and document the Battle of Midway, which then he turns into a film that back home will become incredibly influential as it plays in just about every theater in America.
Right. The Battle of Midway was the first time that home front audiences really got to see American troops in combat. They got to see an actual battle. They got to see it in color, which was even more unusual. And it was also the first real news after months of discouraging news from the war in the Pacific after Pearl Harbor, the first real news of an American win. So, yes, it was incredibly important. It played in, I think, three-quarters of all U.S. theaters by the end of its run. And another thing to consider is the movie was only about 18 minutes long, so it didn't replace the entertainment features that people were going to see. It preceded them. And they saw it, but then over weeks they probably saw it over and over and over again as the features changed. So, you know, by the fall of 1942, Midway was really a kind of part of America's general understanding of what was happening in the war and what we were doing in it.
Do you think it's safe to say that most, if not all, of these men went off with certain romantic notions of warfare and maybe personally wanting to test themselves, challenge themselves, and then quickly confronting the realities of war? I was shocked in your book just how fast all of these men were dropped into actual wartime experiences.
Yes, and I think they were shocked by that as well. I mean, I think some of them had romantic notions of it. John Huston certainly thought it was going to be an adventure. Ford had always had this very emotional relationship with wanting to go to sea. Others had more personal reasons. Wyler is the only Jewish director of the five that I write about, and he had been born in a part of France that had at times been occupied by Germans, so for him the war was very personal. But I think no matter the reason any of them went into the war, Capra, for instance, really wanted to prove his patriotism and his Americanness. Mm-hmm. One thing they all had in common was that the war was not what any of them expected. I mean, whatever any one of them thought they were going to get out of it, their actual experience was almost completely different.
How do you think that affected them coming back after the war and the rest of their careers? Some of them, with the case particularly in George Stevens, I think, went off to war thinking he would not continue being a director when he returned, but of course he did for many years. But how do you think their wartime experience maybe affected their films in the later 40s and into the 50s?
I think it affected them really profoundly. You know, it's funny because the whole reason I got interested in this in the first place was that I became aware that I hadn't really paid attention to the gap in the resumes of these directors. The fact that, you know, in the early and mid-40s, they didn't make very many movies. So I assumed that they had gone to war. But in film history, as opposed to war history, we see that period as a kind of void for them, a temporary interruption after which they resumed their careers. But really, those years shaped what they did later. I mean, Stevens came back a profoundly changed man. He himself said that after filming the liberation of Dachau, he was so deeply shaken that he felt he could never make another one of the kind of out-and-out comedies that he had made before the war, and in fact, he never did. Capra was affected in a really different way. He came back, and really alone among the five, had viewed the war as a kind of horrible interruption after which Hollywood would resume its old ways. He wasn't really prepared for the degree to which the world had changed, and so in some ways, even though he made what is really his best-remembered movie It's a Wonderful Life right after the war, the failure of that movie, and it was a failure at the time, really derailed the rest of his career. He never directed anything of note again. And Wyler came back as a disabled veteran. He lost his hearing in an unpressurized plane while filming the Italian coastline for a documentary, and so he came back to Hollywood not knowing at all if he would ever be able to direct again, and took a lot of that pain and fear and frustration and put it into his post-war masterpiece, The Best Years of Our Lives.
These five directors that you chose would certainly be considered by students of the golden age of Hollywood to be in the pantheon. Number of them were not ever beyond embellishing their own histories, shall we say, or mythologizing their past. But I was really taken, particularly with John Ford, who was one of the most egregious people to do that with his own history. how long it took him to talk about some of those war experiences, especially D-Day?
It's very interesting because Ford was a big embellisher. He did exaggerate what he did, and it's a strange thing for him to have done because what he actually did was enormously impressive. He genuinely did put himself at harm's way. He was supervising with George Stevens the filming of D-Day. He stood on a power station at Midway and filmed Japanese enemy planes flying overhead. So much of his war work was really remarkable. And you know, yes, some of them tended to exaggerate or ornament or embellish their war stories. But, you know, we have to say that that is certainly not unique to movie directors. You know, exaggerating the danger you're in and the combat you faced and what was going on around you seems to be a kind of occupational hazard for a lot of people who go to war. Not most, but many, you know.
And I was really taken, particularly with he and George Stevens' recollections of D-Day, that, you know, the enormity of what they saw and the truth was so much bigger than anything they could sort of mythologize about that. So,
right, and I think Ford said that his memory of D-Day is honestly never seeing more than 10 or 12 men at a time, and that struck me as very, very honest, that this little kind of micro view of what's happening right around you mm-hmm. is the way a lot of people experience war. You don't get a sky's eye view of it when you're in the middle of it.
You're clearly a film scholar and student of history. The book involves enormous amounts of research. It's very well footnoted. I wonder, along that journey creating the book, if there were some surprises you found that...
I think the surprise for me, you know, the journey in doing a book like this, which is the first really big project I've ever undertaken where no one that I was writing about was still alive and could be talked to. The journey for me over the years of research was trying to understand who these men were enough so that I felt I could write honestly about them as people without, you know, feeling that I was doing too much guesswork. And so I was very fortunate in that all five directors have their papers archived at various universities or libraries. And one of the big revelations for me was to read their letters home to their kids or to their wives, because you get a really unvarnished, in a way, view of people from how they talk to their loved ones. And reading those letters was tremendously important for me because I tend to think of these guys as filmmaking giants, and when you see footage of them being interviewed, it was largely from the end of their careers. But here they were coming to life again in my hands as 35-year-olds and as 40-year-olds, as people with a large portion of their careers and their lives still ahead of them and great aspirations for the future. And so beginning to experience them as men in young middle age really helped me put my head in their heads.
Well, you've developed a riveting account of an enormous part of our history as a country and also our Hollywood history, and I want to thank you for that achievement and thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I've been discussing the book Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood in the Second World War with author Mark Harris. Harris's extraordinarily well-researched and written account of five Hollywood directors who went off to war and changed the way Americans understood and experienced that war at home has just been issued in paperback. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.